So anyhow, we're a lecture behind. I don't know how I'm going to catch up. Maybe I'll just cancel the next exam. I'll just give everybody a 70 and we'll figure it out somehow. We gotta keep talking about the condition called epilepsy. Remember, epilepsy, a term that generally describes a number of different potential pathologies and issues. Periodic transient episodes, the type of episode depends on two major factors: where the initial focus of epileptic activity is. And by epileptic activity, I mean uncoordinated, high-frequency axon firings. Where does that start? And then how much of the CNS eventually becomes involved with that upset? I described to you a couple of conditions that probably, in the strict sense, would not be considered epilepsy. One occurring in myself and one in my daughter. Both, however, being controlled by an epileptic medication. So, the moral there is, just because you're going to be dispensing an epileptic medication does not necessarily mean that the individual has epilepsy. In contrast, just because it's an anti-epileptic medication doesn't mean it can't be used for something else. Now, the final point before I get into the drugs, if you will, is this. Because there's such a wide variety of potential forms of epilepsy, it probably makes sense to understand that it's not one size fits all. That there might be certain drugs that are more amenable and more applicable to certain types of epilepsy. In fact, as you remember, we had two different screening tests that were commonly used. Maximal electroshock vis-a-vis minimal electroshock, hemoshock, and those just basically discriminated whether you had Gromol or Timol. We didn't do anything about the other 25 forms. It was just kind of hit and miss. Okay? We didn't have any disco ball screening device in a rat lab, if you will. So a lot of what we did was empiric, hit and miss types of things. The drugs. Well, hopefully it doesn't come as too much of a shock to you to understand that drug therapy for the it should come as no shock to you that we didn't really have good drug control, and notice that I've just used twice the word control, because after all, it's not a cure. I mean, this is like hypertension. Alpha blockade does not cure hypotension. What does it do? It reverses the symptoms, okay? We're controlling the epilepsy. And what we're going to be doing with our therapy is we're going to find that balance where we are minimizing the number of and or the severity of those epileptic episodes, while on the other side minimizing the potential for toxicity I mean, we'd like to just keep increasing the dose until we have zero episodes and zero severity, but unfortunately, something happened. About ready to explode. Zero severity, but unfortunately that doesn't happen. By the way, found out AV in their cost-cutting measures, whatever is broken in that, they don't have a spare. So they had to order it. It'll be here sometime next week, is what I heard. You know, the check is in the mail. So we'll see how long we have to do that. Probably about the same time all the clocks keep working. So we're controlling. And our first control, if you will, came with the discovery, as we were going through general sedative hypnotics, of that alteration to the malonyl-urea ring, where we put phenyl groups on, phenobarbital, a compound that is not very hypnotic, at best is mildly sedative, but at even extremely low doses, it was able to control epilepsy. And with the advent of phenobarbital, then, we start discovering that indeed epilepsy can be controlled. Well, there were three anticonvulsive barbiturates originally. By far and away, the most popular one became phenobarbital. Cheap. Let's start there. And as you'll see, well, I'll put the next one down. Phenobarb's original trade name was Luminol. Methobarbital, or Meborol, was a methylated phenobarb. So what did you have to do to get to the active ingredient? You had to N-demethylate, which meant that in order for the compound to be effective, you had to have what? These are the easy ones, folks. You had to have a liver, a functioning liver. Boy, she really destroyed you this morning, didn't she? Who's buried in Grant's tomb? Let me ask this one. Let me ask this one as long as I want in my field. See, I have hallucinations and stuff. Quiz Bowl, Central Michigan University's PBS station, takes some high school kids runs to get a quiz bowl. You know. One of the questions this Wednesday night, and trust me, it's not one of my top 10 shows, but I'm looking around and I see, I think it was Rostam that was on some school that I'm familiar with. But, the question is, name the state that Mike Huckabee and Bill Clinton was the governor of. And it was 0 for 8. Nobody knew it. Nobody rang in. And finally, the guy that's asking the question is, anybody want to guess? And one kid guessed Oklahoma. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of stay up. It's like what did Michael Jackson take just before he died? You got to, you know, one of the things about being a professional is you're kind of on top of current events. Yeah, Arkansas, right? White water and all that kind of good stuff. Of course, that's ancient history. Yes. Okay, now I've blown another 5 minutes. we need a liver and the methylated, okay? And the third compound, Geminil, or Metharbital, instead of two phenyl groups, we have just one. And the other group, what a shock, what do you think it is? The other R on that malonyl-urea, besides the phenyl, we have a methyl. And surprise, surprise, not nearly as efficacious. Okay, so that didn't go very far either. Phenobarbital became a problem in barbiturate very quickly. The other two just hung around so that nobody got into any monopoly type of litigation, if you will. Okay? Again, what's nice about phenobarb is that it is an effective anti-epileptic at doses that are only mildly sedative, as opposed to the other general sedative hypnotics, where to get any kind of anti-epileptic activity at all, you have to hypnotize them. You have to pretty much put them under. Okay? Now, when I say effective, I'm not saying 100%. Its usefulness is basically for grand mal, and for a type of epilepsy known as psychomotor, also known as temporal lobe. Oh, sorry. I'm wrong. Jacksonian or focal cortical types of epilepsies. This one, grand mal, this one, focal cortical. In fact, the other two on this page, it may make worse. Okay? So that's where it was basically used. And again, even when effective, it was not effective in every case. But it was a start. And so we started using a lot of phenobarb for epilepsy. And the thing about the utilization of phenobarb for epilepsy, chronic low doses of phenobarb, we started observing the development of toxicities that we were not aware of with the use of the generalized CNS depressants in terms of acute overdose. The respiratory depression thing I talked about a couple of weeks ago, and other acute toxicities. If you took the whole bottle of phenobarb, you'd have the problem. But we started seeing chronic types of situations starting to occur. One of the more serious was the development of a rash. And that rash was generally described as scarlatinophore, that is, looking like a sunburn. It occurs in, depending on the study you're looking at, anywhere from 1 to 3% of the people who use phenobarb chronically. And the problem with that rash is that if you did not remove the phenobarb, you would develop what is called exfoliative dermatitis, which is kind of a fancy way of saying you start shedding your skin. Exfoliative dermatitis, not a very nice thing to have. And yes, you can reverse it, but it means that you're going to have to discontinue the phenobarb, and if you are epileptic, now what? Okay. That's one of the problems. And it's fairly, shall we say, not specific at this point, but it tends to occur more often with the barbiturate than in the others. Now, there are some other things that since we've developed more drugs, we find shared with other anti-epileptic types of medications. Anti-epileptics in general tend to cause a condition called megaloblastic anemia. That is, they interfere with the maturation of red blood corpuscles. And so we get a blastic form that's released by the bone marrow instead of the mature RBC. The numbers are okay, but because we are in immature form, our oxygen carrying capacity is not what it should be. And so we get anemic, megaloblastic anemia. We'll talk more about that when we talk blood disorders and products next semester. A softening of the bone, osteomalacia. Vision issues. Double vision common, diplopia. Another one that tends to be very common is a condition called nystagmus. That's where the muscles cause one or both of the eyes to move spasmodically, can't keep focused on one point. Very disconcerting, not only to the individual, but anybody trying to look at them or talk to them. Okay, so all sorts of issues with chronic barbiturate administration start developing. And as you might suspect, that was one of the things that led us to look at other types of medications for epilepsy. And very quickly, we come up with a ring structure called the high Danpon structure. You've had epilepsy, right? Was that the test this morning? Okay. So you guys know how similar high Danpon ring structure is to the barbiturate structure? Okay. It's like a first cousin, pretty close, okay? And you know, historically, we have had trouble in pharmacology and med chem breaking out of a paradigm. You know, we have this paradigm of the fact that general depressants to get sedative and hypnotic and anesthetic activity, you just had to keep this dose response going. It wasn't until the benzodiazepines came along that we broke free from that. Well, the paradigm with epilepsy for a long time was, if you're going to have an anti-epileptic drug, it better look damn similar to what? Barbiturate, in terms of the general ring structure. Hydantoins come along, okay? Three of them. They're all hydantoin rings put together by Park Davis down in Ann Arbor. And Park Davis markets three of them. Phenytoin. Used to be a lot easier name to remember because it was called diphenylhydantoin. That was its generic name. Diphenylhydantoin. Two phenyl groups on the hydantoin ring. One shot. Very similar to phenobarb. Phenytoin. Diphenyl. Okay? This is medication that I took for a number of years. And medication my daughter took for a number of years. Mephenytoin. A lot like Meverol. What a shock. Mesentoin. And then, let's put a different group on instead of a methyl group. What are we going to put on? An ethyl group. Yippee. Oreganone. Ephetoin. By far and away, phenytoin becomes the most dominant and the most popular. And the reason for that was this hierarchy. For both effect, that is efficacy, and toxicity, the methyl structure is much better than the diphenyl structure. The methyl phenyl is most efficacious, but unfortunately, it is also the most toxic, has the greatest incidence of toxicity. And on the other hand, the ethyl structure is a lot less toxic, but at the same time, it's a lot less effective. So the best combination of the two things we are trying to balance is phenytoin. and so it becomes the dominant player in the market. Mechanism of action I'll get into probably on Monday. The thing I want to mention about phenytoin, it tends to be highly protein bound, as do a number of these compounds, so that it is with phenytoin that we really start developing a chart that I have for you out of the textbook. Okay. Because of protein binding on one hand, because of some metabolism issues on the other, as you put, what is it, AED? It's not automatic external defibrillator in this case. It's anti-epileptic drug. You can have a lot of potential drug interactions, not only with other anti-epileptics that are also either highly protein-bound or metabolized, but also a number of other different drugs. That is, it was problems with phenytoin in particular as an anti-epileptic that got us into the whole idea of drug interactions and potential issues because of that. A person who would be taking phenytoin for quite a while and be doing quite nicely and be put on another drug for another condition, and either one, they would start developing a toxicity, or just as badly, they would start developing an increased incidence of seizures. So it became a real issue. So we have phenytoin. Phenytoin pretty much, what a shock. It looks like phenobarbital, okay? It sounds like quacks like phenobarbital. It walks like phenobarbital. It's not a surprise that it's going to act like phenobarbital. You know, looking like a duck, quacking like a duck is a duck. So phenytoin pretty much useful for the same types of conditions as phenobarb. It tended to be more useful than phenobarb for psychomotor, however. But still, in terms of the T-law, we had real problems in terms of any kind of adequate therapy for that condition at this point in time. As we started using hydantoins, we started seeing some chronic issues. One of the things with hydantoins that we didn't see so much with phenobarb are some central nervous system issues. Muscular incoordination, some issues with fast, normal, high frequency impulses going between the cerebellum and the motor cortex, all sorts of coordination problems. You notice the dashed line leading from the fifth one down, speech disturbances. That was all about muscular incoordination, getting the tongue and the jaws to act in a coordinated fashion. And, you know, I'd like to say that the problems I have with speech to this day may, in fact, be residual from my 10 years of phenytoin use. By the way, not uncommon every once in a while with an epileptic medication to back off, go on a drug holiday, if you will, because we found out fairly early in the game that sometimes an epileptic condition can spontaneously remit. One day you got epilepsy, for some reason the focus dissolves, goes to sleep, so the next door neuron pounds on it or something, but you don't see it anymore. It remits. So every once in a while, I put it off on my medication. I can get a headache. When I was about 33, 34, I've been teaching here 3 or 4 years. And so I haven't taken it since. But maybe the speech disturbed, you know, I'd like to think it's still bad. You know, the idea of Alzheimer's is kind of disconcerting, so. But tremors, another muscle issue. We saw the eye issues. In addition, a condition known as ptosis. P-T-O-S-I-S, ptosis. Drooping eyelids. Couldn't keep the eyes open, okay? And sometimes, very rarely, the condition would develop where somebody on phenytoin would start hallucinating. So some CNS issues. On the GI tract, phenytoin tended to be somewhat irritating. So every once in a while there would be some upper GI distress, some nausea maybe, but more commonly it was issues surrounding chronic pain. Kind of a burning pain, described most of the time. Not a true heartburn, but a milder, rather constant achy burn. But the one that tended to be very characteristic of hydantoin, and still is very characteristic of hydantoin, is the condition known as gingiva hyperplasia. Now, depending on the study, it occurred in anywhere up to 1/4 of patients. And what, as this, it kind of is described, what happens is the gingival tissue tends to grow, overgrow. And in severe cases, it would completely cover up the teeth. The new growth tissue was very fragile. And so there was a lot of bleeding and scarring associated with its growth. Oral hygiene becomes quite difficult. And in severe cases, just eating becomes an issue, chewing. But the biggest problem is self-image. You smile like this. You know, show no teeth, particularly as you might suspect, of, you know, I hate to be sexist, but it's more of a female issue. But in both genders, what happens when this starts happening? You know, we got to make a decision. Do I want to have a seizure or do I want to look like shit? And so what happens? Compliance goes out the window. And one thing about anti-epileptic medications is they have to be consistent in terms of blood levels. You can't be doing this. So gingiva hyperplasia becomes a big problem in terms of hydantoin therapy. Okay? In addition, we've got another issue, more again with the female than with the male, and that is that in terms of dermal, chronic hydantoins tended to promote hair growth, hirsutism, in all sorts of places. There tended to be liver issues. It developed, and again, there tended to be a rash that formed. Now, this rash was more of an allergic type of issue, and notice that the name is more biliform. Think of that as measles. You can have a rash that's pustular, you know, like pox, or blister, but this rash is like measles, okay? More biliform. Now, the reason that I highlight this is the fact that for a number of years, while I was a pharmacist, okay, Bart Davis made a combination product, phenytoin with phenobarb. okay, let's try and get double the efficacy with maybe less chance of toxicity. And if you were on this combination product and you developed a rash, we didn't want to completely pull you off of all of your epileptic medication, okay? We would rather just take one away. So what did we look for? Whether the rash was scarlatiniform or morbilliform. And say, oh, okay, let's take one away. Now, before I go in too much farther, okay, let's just understand that these were the generalities. Every once in a while with a hydantoin, you'd get a scarlatiniform rash, and vice versa. It wasn't just like it was always morbilliform. But we played the percentages. Most of the time, what was the rash with hydantoin? Morbilliform. And so that would be the one we would tend to eliminate if we're on the combination product. And I'll get into the whole idea of polypharmacy vis-a-vis single drug probably next Monday. So we have these two major products for Guam Mall. As of the early to mid-50s, we still have a real issue with Tatimol. What comes along at that point in time is a drug structure and again I would imagine maybe they don't do this. If you look at this ring structure, it's not that dissimilar to the hydantoin structure. It's called oxazolidine dione. This was Abbott Laboratories in Chicago about the same time that they came up with halothane, and they trade named the drug tridione. And for maybe 2 or 3 years, this becomes the drug to use in Petit Mal. It's almost just Petit Mal in nature. It's quite toxic. Just some of the things that we discovered with it. People started developing scotomata, S-C-O-T-O-M-A-T-A, blind spots in their vision. In addition, there's another neat one to spell, H-E-M-E-R. How are we doing, Tommy? A-L-O-P-I-A, hemeralopia, fancy name for 4-day vision. Sunlight became an issue. A variety of skin rashes. It's nephrotoxic. And it is severely depressant on the blood formation, a condition we call PAM, P-A-M, cytopenia. Your ability to produce cells and red blood corpuscles gets depressed significantly. A toxic drug. So we said, okay, this is a start, but we got to do better than this. And what comes out, again, it's Park Davis down in Ann Arbor. In the mid to late 50s, come up with it. Let's go that way. The succinimides. Okay, succinimides. There are three. Remember there were three high-band coins? Same thing. Fensuximide. You can see from the generic names, they're fooling around with what's on the ring structure. And much like with phenytoin, one of these becomes the predominant compound within just a couple of years. And that's this one. And so I'll give you its trade name, because it's still a drug of second choice in T-law, ethosuximide or zoranthin. And again, why is this the dominant one? Because it is the best balance between toxicity and efficacy. Used primarily in Petit-Mal. Okay. Some mild GI complaints. But it does have a tendency to produce or promote, if you will, anorexic behavior. Not sure if it's a taste issue or what, but the people that get on it tend to become anorexic. We have to watch their nutrition. The other major thing is that it tends to produce some dizziness. But the one that kind of came out of the blue, and we still haven't got a good reason why, is chronic hiccups. Who knew? But it became an issue as well. But again, the succinylamide is a similar structure, ring-wise, to barbiturate. And so from about the late 50s, early 60s, until the early to mid-1970s, this is our armamentarium for epilepsy. Phenobarb, phenytoin, zoranthin. And we are in this paradigm that what does an anti-epileptic have to look like? Kind of a barbiturate nucleus with phenyl or ethyl or methyl or whatever we want to slap on. Two things occur in the early to mid-70s that completely break us out of this paradigm. Two drugs become established. The first of these is an aminostilbene that becomes generically named carbamazepine, and its trade name tegretol. And remember my buddy that finally was cured down in Ann Arbor, or Detroit, wherever it was. Tegretol is the drug he took for about the last 10, 12 years of his pre-surgery as his anti-epileptic. Carbamazepine or Tegretol. Now, this becomes marketed for its anti-epileptic activity in the early to mid-70s. I dispensed this drug because the wife of the owner of the pharmacy I worked in had a condition, kind of an orphan drug condition, for which this drug was found to be useful. And it's the reason why it was on the market. The condition is known as trigeminal neuralgia, also known as tic douloureux, painful tic. as part of this neuralgic symptom, pain in the trigeminal nerve, you have this spasmodic twitching on one side of your face. Kind of disconcerting, if you will. And carbamazepine, aminostilbenes, were found to be very effective at controlling this. And we've known about that since the mid to late 50s. But serendipity being what it is, guess what we've started to latch on to? People that had tic douloureux and epilepsy, we started seeing some amelioration of the epileptic conditions. And so we said, why not? So we ran a few clinical trials against various types of epilepsies and found it to be highly effective. Carbamazepine, the aminostilbene structure, interestingly enough, is, I think, looks like this. Is anybody copying this down? Damn it, this is med chem. Where to get that mess? That's an aminostilbene with a, guess what? A tail? What's the word I used all last semester? Or I'm using all this semester, I'm sorry. It's a kite. We'll find that that's very similar to antidepressant structure, very similar to antipsychotic structure, tricyclic structure. Never gave it a thought that it might be anti-epileptic. Interesting. The other serendipity that occurs in the mid-70s, and this will be the segue to tomorrow, is a lot of our anti-epileptic drugs we were trying have solubility issues. So we were looking for various solvent systems. And one of the solvent systems that was utilized contained a solvent known as valproic acid. And being good pharmacologists, we ran a control. And guess what happened with the control? It showed efficacy. So we started breaking the control out and found out that a very simple organic structure known as valproic acid is also an anti-epileptic. All right, we'll see you on